Cool. Well, can everyone hear me okay? Okay, great. Well, we have, I think, 75 minutes together, and hopefully it'll be a jam-packed session full of lots of new content. This is actually the first time I've ever given this talk, so I have no idea whether it's going to be 60 minutes or 4 hours in length, hopefully somewhere in between. Please ask questions along the way. I'll leave us a little bit of time, hopefully at the end, to answer some questions. And for the most part, we're going to try to make this as demo-rich as possible. And so you're going to see a lot of coding and a lot of real-world code running. You'll be able to do all these demos that I'm going to be showing here today on your own machines in a couple of days. Because I'm actually pleased to announce up front that the ASP.NET MVC 4 beta is going to be coming out later this week. And so all these bits are fresh. I'm going to be doing all the demos on VS 2010. And again, you'll be able to do these on your own machine shortly. So lots of new features coming in ASP.NET MVC 4. How many people here have installed any previous preview of MVC 4? A few people have, but for the most part, partly because my blog has been sort of quiet since I've been busy working pretty hard the last 6 months. I haven't actually blogged a lot about it, so the good news is hopefully all these features will be, for the most part, new to you. I think one of the things you'll hopefully see at the end of the session is that there's a lot of great stuff coming and a lot of value you can get immediately out of the box using the product. And so I'm going to go through six things today, just kind of walking through in terms of how they work. And again, we'll try to show a sample or two for each of them and kind of illustrate what you can do with it. All these above features will work, again, with VS 2010 and .NET 4. So ASP.NET MVC 4 is kind of a unique release in that it's going to work not only with the current shipping version of Visual Studio and .NET, it'll also be built into the next version of Visual Studio, we call codename VS 11. But you don't need VS 11 in order to do everything I'm going to do here. We're going to support both versions with this release. Hopefully that means also that you can adopt it as quick as possible. ASP.NET MVC 4 is also designed so that it's fully bin deployable. So you don't have to install anything on a server in order to use it. In fact, all these demos I'm going to show here today, you could upload into Azure today or any hosting environment out there on the internet. So let's go ahead and get started. First thing I'm going to do, even before we delve into the features, is just show off kind of one minor thing, which I think is kind of nice with this release, which is kind of a revamped project experience. So if you do File New Project, you'll notice if you install MVC 4 on VS 2010, you'll have actually MVC 2, MVC 3, and MVC 4 that you can actually run all side by side. And if we want to, we can create a new project. What would you like to call it? Oh, come on. What? You're done? I actually don't know what that. Okay. Poltergeist. Something that's hard to spell. Okay, Poltergeist. There we go. Okay. So we're going to call this Poltergeist. One of the things you'll notice in the new project dialog on MVC 4 is we have a few new options. I'm going to be walking through a couple of those a little bit later, including mobile and web API support. I'm just going to use the standard internet project template. We had this in MVC 3. And it basically scaffolds for you kind of a default site with a bunch of files and scripts automatically included. One thing just to note when you run it is the new version is a little bit more attractive than the old version and includes a couple additional options. And so you can run it here. It looks a little bit more modern in terms of styling. It's still very easy to customize. So if you want to place in your own custom content, it's really easy to do so. It also, in addition to kind of about and context support, we also now have Ajax-based login and registration. It'll fall back if you don't have script. But trying to make the site overall more modern uses media queries. So you'll see a little bit later on, this will actually work fine on a mobile device. So regardless of whether you want to scale this down to any screen resolution, it's all adaptive. It does use HTML5 by default inside the project templates. But we use Modernizer. So if you even have IE6, the app and site still works. But we're using kind of clean semantic markup for everything. So that's just kind of File New Project. We're going to come back to that and add a bunch more features into it. But that's something you can kind of take advantage of and use to get started really quickly. First thing I want to do, though, is talk about a new feature that's built into MVC and which the project template by default has enabled. And that's called bundling and minification. I guess it's technically two features, but you usually typically use them together. How many people here are using bundling and minification today? How many people have no idea what bundling and minification is? How many people here thought they were here for another movie? Cool. Okay. Well, so bundling minification. Basically, the goal behind this, it's pretty simple. If you're building a web app, you want to use this feature. Basically, it enables you to improve the performance of your websites and have your users' experience be much faster. It works with all browsers. There really isn't any good reason not to use it. Actually, there is a good reason not to use it. In the past, it's kind of been a pain to set up because you typically have to do it as kind of a post-development exercise. You have to write a bunch of code in order to enable it, so it's been kind of a pain. The good news is with MVC 4, as well as with ASP.NET 4.5, so this is true for web forms as well, bundling and minification is now a built-in feature of the box, and it's really easy in order to take advantage of. And the idea behind bundling and minification is basically to reduce the number and size of your HTTP requests when a page loads. So often today, you might have load three script files on a page, and so you have three linked references to those script files. Today, those would be three separate HTTP requests. With bundling, you take the three requests, you put them together into one HTTP request, and that means that there's fewer requests in the browser. The browser will typically download and load things faster, and from a user perspective, your site feels more responsive. But as a developer, the benefit of bundling minification is you can still split up your files into separate JS files, so it's still easy to manage and coordinate. Same is true for CSS. Bundling minification allows you to have multiple CSS files at development time, but allows you to kind of merge them together into a single CSS file that you download to the client at runtime. Again, allows your page and site to load faster. Where minification comes into play, it's another feature, and you can use it separately from bundling or together. We typically see them used together. Is with minification, we'll actually, when we're merging those CSS or JavaScript files together, we'll strip out all comments, we'll strip out all white space, and we'll try to condense down the file as much as possible. And then at the last step, we'll compress it even further with gzip over the wire. And again, makes your files a lot smaller, means that your pages load faster, and your overall experience for your users just ends up speeding up and being good. It works by convention. You don't need to configure anything in order to enable it by default. I'll walk through exactly how that works. And at the same time, it's also fully customized and extensible. So if you want to do your own custom pre-processors or post-processors in the process, there's a nice extensibility point in order to plug in. So how does this work? Well, so let's say, for example, you've got a default project today. You might have a scripts folder and a styles folder with a bunch of individual files within it. And today what you often do if you want to reference all, say, seven of these JavaScript or CSS files is you just put separate links to each of those files within your HTML. And the browser loads, it'll request them separately, and then once they're all loaded, the browser will render and display. So that's typically how you do it today. The downside, though, is you're going to make separate HTTP requests for each of those files, and that's going to take a while because most browsers only allow a max number of requests at a time. If you have white space in them or comments in them, your files are also going to be bigger. So the idea behind bundling and minification by default with MVC 4, it's pretty simple. Basically, what you can do now is you can replace all seven of those calls or six of those calls with one call. And basically, you can just reference the directory, which is in this case styles, and then you say slash CSS if you want to get all the CSS files or slash JS if you want to get all the JavaScript files. And when you do that, it'll send a single HTTP request to the server. ASP.NET by default now will look in that folder and say, oh, I'm going to merge all those CSS files together into one payload. It'll reduce all the white space. It'll get rid of all the comments and send down a single payload back to the browser. The beauty as a developer, you still work with separate files, so you can still manage them the way you do today, but the browser just gets a lot faster. Likewise, for JavaScript, you can do the exact same thing. Just say script slash JS, and it could be any folder, so it could be foo slash JS, and then ASP.NET will just merge all those files together and send down a single HTTP response to the browser in order to render it. Again, just makes it faster. You don't need to actually configure anything. It just works. So let's see some demos of this in action. And so if you actually want to see, let's go to this file right here. So let's actually come back to our Poltergeist project in just a second. But to begin with, we'll load this project right here. So this is a simple app. We'll just load it up here. And it's just a simple sample. And I'll post all the code and, a little bit later on in my blog so you can download all this. Basically, I have a simple file here. Whoops, we got a little bit of clipping. What it does is it's just got a couple links to individual files. And if I open up this index right now, you can see basically what we're doing here is I'm just using standard anchor links so I can show you off these different files. And I basically have a link to the content/CSS, script/custom.js, my custom bundle, coffee and less. And we'll look at each of these in just a second. But basically, these are using the convention-based approach for how ASP.NET can merge in and bundle these resources together and send down a single HTTP response with the output. So let's see what that looks like. So if I say content/CSS, which is that first link, it's going to make a request, and ASP.NET will look in the content folder. And you'll notice here I have a reset.css and a site.css file that I've defined for this app. How many people here use a reset.css file? A few people know. It's a trick. Eric Meyer popularized it. Basically allows you to kind of avoid differences between browsers, and it kind of clears out all the styles that are browser-specific. And then site.css has my site-specific style information. So it's pretty common to have two separate style sheets to do that, one called reset, one called site. If I included them by default today as two separate links, I'd have two separate HTTP requests, though. And you'll notice I do have comments and some white space in these files. What I can do instead is I can just have a single content/CSS URL to it, and when I request it, this is what the file gets sent back from ASP.NET. You can basically see what ASP.NET did was it merged the two style sheets in that folder together and sent down a single HTTP payload, stripped out of all white space, stripped out of all comments, and the browser can then just render it and use it as is. And in fact, if you look at my view source of this actual page here, you can see, just blew up the font. You can actually see here, for this HTML, I have at the top, I'm just referencing content/CSS, and so this actual page itself is just pulling those two files as a single HTTP request. Likewise, for JavaScript, I can bundle multiple files together, and so in this case here, I have custom/JavaScript, so I'm using a subfolder underneath my scripts folder called custom. I have three files in there, ECMAScript, GoToDefinition, XML doc. Notice that I have comments and I have a lot of white space in them. Again, if I go ahead and click this file, IE is going to ask me, do I want to open it? And then it's going to say, security-wise, I shouldn't do it, but I'm going to ignore it and open up a notepad and hit open, which is a long, convoluted way to get that. But basically, when I do that, notice how small the JavaScript that was sent down was. It's because it stripped out all the white space, stripped out all the comments, merged them into a single file, and downloaded it for me. The beauty here is if I ever make a code change, I can do it just like I usually would today. I could just change my font size. By default, let's make it 2 instead of that. Go back here, hit refresh. The font's big now, but I'm still bundling and minifying that CSS. And so it's still super efficient. If I go back and change it, and do that, hit refresh, and it immediately takes effect. So I get all the benefits of fewer HTTP requests, all built-in benefits of minifying and shrinking down my files, but the same dev time, just make a change, hit save, refresh, kind of rapid dev experience. I don't need to run any custom tools. I don't need to run any custom post-build step, and I get great performance. Other thing that's nice about this bundling minification feature is, you notice here I'm using it by what we call convention, meaning I just reference this as /script/custom/JS, and it will automatically include all the files. I don't need to explicitly register the files in order for it to work. But if I want to, I can define what's called a custom bundle inside my global.asax. And so if I want to statically define a bundle, I can do that. In this case here, I'm creating a my custom bundle URL. And then I explicitly say I want to add these four files into that bundle. And if I want to do that, then I can just reference this as well. This is a custom bundle. And it's just going to include those four specific files that I mentioned. And those files can be from any folder or any set of directories on disk, and it basically merges and sends it down. So you can use the convention approach to get without having to write any code, or you can use this explicit approach if you want to have custom rules set up in order to use it. How many people here are using CoffeeScript? No one. Okay, cool. How many people have heard of CoffeeScript? Cool. Well, what CoffeeScript is, it's sort of another way to write JavaScript. It's a JavaScript-like syntax, except it's actually a little bit, well, some people say it's a lot cleaner in that the way you define things can be kind of a little bit more functional. So it's kind of its own language, but it compiles down to JavaScript, so it works inside any browser. Some people love it, some people hate it, it's sort of controversial. But it's an example of kind of a macro processor that takes kind of a higher level language, compiles it down into JavaScript. How many people here have used less? Cool. How many people have used SAS? They're both CSS languages. Again, like CoffeeScript, you write in a higher level language. In this case here, this is an example of less. So it's kind of like CSS, except you'll notice I can define variables. So in this case here, I'm saying the brand color is this, and then I can basically use the brand color inside my CSS rules. And the idea behind less is at runtime, again, you compile it into standard CSS, and it just works with any browser. But both less and CoffeeScript, the goal is let you program at a higher level language. At runtime, it just works with any browser. What's nice about the bundling minification feature is you can integrate higher level languages like this because the bundling minification feature has a plugin pipeline that allows you to integrate custom rules and custom engines. And so all I need to do in order to enable that is inside my global.sax, I just define two new custom bundle rules. They're called dynamic folder bundles. And so I can just say, run this coffee minify class, which we'll look at in a second, on any coffee file with or something with a coffee extension. Run any of this less minify on top of any file with a .less extension. And then at runtime, we'll actually take the coffee script, convert it to JavaScript, take the less files, convert it to standard CSS. And the benefit here is you don't need to run any tools or any custom processors to make it work. Instead, you can just, inside your view files, just reference them. So I could just do a standard link HTML to that URL, and it'll go ahead and work. And or I can just point to that coffee directory, and away it works. And so if I click this dynamic less bundle, this is that less file actually turned into vanilla CSS. And likewise, this is that CoffeeScript set of files turned into vanilla JavaScript. And so that's what that code would look like when it's actually compiled down to standard JavaScript. Again, the beauty here is you don't need to run a tool. You don't need to do a custom build step. You can just wire up these bundler rules. And then if you want to, you can just use CoffeeScript and less within your projects. And at runtime, ASP.NET will automatically generate the files for you. And to write these types of things, if you want to write a custom one, this is all it takes in order to write a custom bundle processor for CoffeeScript. And it just calls into a CoffeeScript compiler that's open source. And likewise, if you want to bundle in less. So if you do have custom rules that you want to make sure you say always include a copyright or something like that, you just create one of these files, you override the process command, and you can add a couple of steps in order to do it. So it makes it really easy out of the box to make your sites faster. And again, it's fully extensible. Last thing I'll just mention in terms of performance, we have built into ASP.NET MVC a couple of what we call resolve bundle URL helpers. These are a little verbose at the moment in the beta. We're going to probably just call it HTML.bundle with the release candidate. But basically, it provides a way that just like you can point to a unique directory explicitly, it works the same way, except one of the things it also does is when you run it at runtime, view source, you can see, when you use that helper method, it will also automatically add what's called a cache busting token onto the URL. And what that means is that we'll look at the files and the timestamps and the content of the files, and we'll automatically add that as a URL. So that, and then we'll send down with the HTTP status. And so if I do F12 to bring up my tools, turn on network capturing, and hit refresh. By default, if you look at the response header inside here for the expires tag, you'll see that each of these files, it has an expiration date of a year from now. And so by default, when we actually send down the CSS and the JavaScript, we'll say cache this thing on the client for up to a year. So that'll be cached at a proxy server or on your Edge client. But because we append on that unique token, if the files ever change, you'll automatically pick up the new version within the browser. So the benefit there is, again, your user experience gets a lot faster. It's fully cached on the client. It's really small. It's automatically compressed. And you as a developer don't have to do anything other than you just change one line of code inside your app to point to the bundle as opposed to the individual file, and your site will get a lot faster. Any questions on that? Cool. So It's a new feature. It works not only with MVC, you can also take advantage of it with web forms or any other project. A couple other features while we're in the view section to call out that are new with this release. One of the things we're doing is we're including a new version of the Razor view engine. How many people here are using Razor with MVC? Okay, a lot of people are. Lots of new kind of improvements that you can take advantage of in here. I'm just going to call out two of them really quickly that a lot of people have often asked for. One is, how many times have you ever had to write code like this today where you say url.content or server.mappath in order to resolve a relative URL to the right qualified URL? It's fairly common. You use them inside script references. You include them inside anchor references. And it basically allows you to kind of handle resolved relative URLs and make them work in the browser. It's kind of a pain to have to write the URL.content. I mean, it works, but it's a little bit verbose. One of the things we now support inside Razor is the ability just to say tilde slash. And if you say tilde slash, we'll automatically resolve that against the root of the app. And Razor will now parse all the HTML attributes looking for anything with the tilde, and will automatically expand it to the proper URL format. So it's a nice small feature, but again, it saves you a little bit of typing, makes your code a little bit cleaner. Next feature here, how many people here ever write Razor code inside attributes of HTML? So conditionally, a few people, conditionally show CSS or not, conditionally set the checked to true value on, say, checkboxes. It's kind of a pain and a little bit ugly today. So today what you might do is have some code that determines whether or not my class should be shiny fancy or something else. And then to actually embed the value, you got to do something a little fancy because you only want to show the attribute if the value is set. So in other words, you don't want to have div class equals empty. You want to hide the class entirely unless the value gets set. And this is kind of the syntax you need to write today in order to enable that. A little gross. What we're enabling with the next release is the ability for you to kind of avoid all that code, and instead on any HTML attribute or any tag element, you can just say div class equals at my class. And Razor's now smart enough so that if my class is set, it'll output class equals the value. If my class is null, it'll emit not only the value, but it won't actually include the attribute on the left-hand side either. And so it'll automatically parse that out, makes the code much cleaner, a lot less typing, and kind of a nice little feature you can take advantage of. Moving on, database migrations. How many people here work with data? What are the people who don't raise their hands? What do you do in a web app? But okay, so the cool thing is, so a lot of people work with data. You know, one of the things we've always focused on a lot with .NET and with Visual Studio is, you know, how do you write code against data? And so we've had Lord knows how many different data controls, data frameworks, and data tooling. And it seems like every release we come up with a new one. One of the things we focused a lot on with this release was not coming up with a new data framework, but rather actually to focus on the problem that we've never really focused on, which is as you're developing your code, how do you actually evolve your schema as you're actually writing your code? Because it turns out very few people actually finalize their database schema on the very first day of the project and then write code against it. Typically, you're evolving your database schema as you actually evolve your app. And a lot of our tooling and a lot of our frameworks in the past have had kind of a brittle relationship when you want to change your database schema. And with this new cool feature called database migrations, which is available in Entity Framework and will be built into MVC4, but it will actually work with any type of .NET project, that makes it a lot easier. Has anyone played with the database migration feature? Cool, only one person has. That's actually good in this talk. It's bad for other reasons, but it's good for this talk because you all get to see it for the first time. So, it's as I mentioned, it's part of the new version of EF 4.3, which actually shipped a couple days ago. So this is actually a shipping version, or shipping feature you can use in any .NET project, web forms, MVC, or WCF, or any other type of project. And it basically provides kind of a nice code-oriented approach to evolving your database schema. It's code-focused, so it doesn't require a design tool. It doesn't require a designer of any type. It's very developer-friendly, and at the end of the day, once you're done as a developer, you can still hand off optionally a .SQL script that you can give a DBA to actually go ahead and run, And you can do it either to create your database, or more importantly, it allows you to kind of effectively evolve your schema between versions. And so you can create a script that says, start with this version 2 and evolve it to the next version of the schema really easily. And so we're going to walk through actually building an app in our Poltergeist app that does that. So let's go back to Poltergeist. It's a good name of a project. Although hopefully I won't have any gremlins in this demo that will warn it. So let's go ahead and, so this is our Poltergeist app. We're going to go ahead and build a simple project. You want to do like a product database or something, or what would you like the schema? Product, okay. Patients, okay. We could do patients. What would a patient have? Okay, let's do a patient. Why not? We'll run our patients through the Poltergeist. So patient table, patient class, does that work? Okay. So we're going to create a class here called patient. And what would a patient have? We'll go ahead and we'll have an ID. We'll go ahead and we'll have a string. Hey, that's enough for now. So we're going to have a patient class, these two properties. Let's go ahead and scaffold out a controller and some views that allow us to edit data with this. And so to do that, I'm going to say add controller. And we'll say patients controller. And I'm going to point to the patient class. And I'm going to create a new data context. And we'll call this the hospital DB context, I guess. I spell that right? Yeah. And hit add. So this is all built into MVC 3. So far what I'm showing here, I'm using Entity Framework code first, so I don't need to use any designer. Instead, I can just write plain old CLR objects, or what we call POCO objects, just have these two properties on them. And by running this scaffolding command, ASP.NET has automatically created for me what's called a DB context class that has that table and a bunch of controllers that do CRUD operations against it, as well as views to render it. So if I now go ahead and hit slash patients, I have a simple page here. I can go ahead and create, what's your name? We're going to operate on you. Lorenzo, okay. There we go. And then I'll add myself as well. And we'll add Bob too. There we go. Okay, so we have simple data-driven CRUD website. We got three records in our patient class, and we're off and running. So the challenge, though, is, you know, as a developer, chances are I'm going to want more than two properties on my database. And so in the past, if I wanted to change it, I could. So let's say, for example, what's another property we should add? Age? Let's start with age. That's easier. So we'll just do age here. And so if I want to go ahead and render that, I'm just going to do one other thing here, which is let's display in addition to the name. I'm just going to say age. And then so I could rescaffold the files, but just so you can see exactly what I'm doing, I'm just going to go ahead and manually update that so you understand the changes I'm making. I'm just going to go ahead, I'm just surfacing the new value that we've added inside our views. Again, I could right-click and auto-regenerate it, but then it might be a little too magical for you. So we exposed age. It's working. Go ahead and hit refresh, and kaboom, I'm going to have an error. And basically, this is by design, don't worry. The reason this error is occurring, if you read the exception message, it's basically saying, hey, the problem is age right now that you've just added is a non-nullable type or property, and you're pointing it to a database that doesn't have an age column within it, within the patients table. And so it's giving me an error saying I'm not going to run at runtime because I could end up causing bad data to occur in the database as a result. So let's do a couple things. First, just so we can get a sense of what that data looks like, let's connect to our SQL Express database. And this is called Poltergeist. And you can see here we have a patients table. And you know what I just realized? I made a mistake. We have a patients table, so we're going to see if I can recover from my mistake. We have a patients table that has two columns in it, one called ID, one called name, which map to the original patient class that we had. So what I'm going to do here is I want to evolve my database schema. What I should have done at the very beginning of this demo is updated to use the latest version of the Entity Framework. So this is actually an issue you got to do with the beta because the Entity Framework just shipped a couple days ago, and so I'm actually using an older version. And so because the framework's already loaded, I just need to reboot VS to pick up the new version. And hopefully what I'm going to find is that everything still just works. So let me run, and hopefully I will still see the same error that we had before. And that would be by design if it works. Good. And so what I'm going to do here is I want to evolve this database schema that has patients to actually have the new age property. So to do that, I'm going to go back to my PowerShell window. So I'm going to go back to my console window. And I'm going to type in a command here, which is called enable migrations. And what's going to happen here when I do this is it basically just enables what we call migration support for this project. And it's going to allow, and it's audited, as part of that, it added for me a new migrations folder into my project. And this basically right now just has a configuration.cs file. What I can do is then take advantage of a feature called add migration, which is another command line option that's enabled as part of this. And I'm going to say add go to my patient folder. Remember, we added a property called age. So I'm going to say add patient age. Oops, sorry. And one second here. This is when I said I should have updated EF first. Let's try that one more time. Okay. It won't defeat me, hopefully. And so what this basically hopefully just did is you'll see here, it just added in this file here called add patient age, what's called a migration. And this is basically a little config file, a code file. It has a timestamp before it, and then it basically has what does it take in order to generate this database to the latest version that we just created. And so what this did was it just basically, because I should have run that tool before, it's adding three properties right now to my database, my ID, my name, and my age. And what I should be able to do then is go back into that window and say update database, and again, just because I screwed that up and I should have run it before, what this should do is, if I hit refresh, I now have a patients table that has all three columns within it. So that was a little rougher. We're going to add another property here to kind of show it off in its full glory. But basically now I'm able to kind of evolve my schema database an easy way. So let me show something a little bit better here now that I have everything wired up. Let's do one other thing, which is let's change name. So right now name is a nullable, non-nullable property, or actually a nullable property because that's the default with SQL for invarchar. So you can see here it says nullable equals true. Let's actually make it required. So with EF code first, I can add a required attribute, which indicates this is a non-nullable type. So I can build that. What I can then do with another migration here is I can say add migration, and I'm going to say change name required. What you'll see when I do that is this will generate another file in my project, which is what's called another migration, which is called change name required. So it's whatever value I specify. And you'll notice that this class now says, hey, when you run this migration, alter the column name to make it nullable. So take the existing column and change it to be nullable. And you'll notice there's a down command, which we'll come back to in a second, which says reverse it so it's non-nullable and back out that change. And now if I go ahead and say update database, and then go back to my database schema, so let's go to Server Explorer again, you'll see that if I hit refresh on patients, that name is not allowed to be nullable. So we basically just change that schema dynamically on the fly. What's cool about all this stuff, though, is when I run it at runtime, what we should see is, because I deleted the database. So if I recreate this, and we'll make one more migration change just to show it's real, you'll find that the data does not get lost. So, for example, let's go ahead and what's another change we could make? Tell you what, let's actually back out the change. So the other nice thing about migrations is in addition to allowing you to roll forward, you can also roll backwards. So I can say update database. I can say target migration, and I'm going to say let's go back to the add patient age migration, like so. And what you'll find here is if I refresh, you'll find that we actually rolled back. We're nullable again. And if I recompile, I hit refresh, we were able to roll back our schema state, but what you should find is the data is still there inside the database. So basically, anytime I run these migrations, as long as I'm not deleting a column, you'll find that basically your data is maintained, and it's very easy for you to kind of roll forward or roll backwards your schema changes with all your data maintained. And again, if I want to roll forward again, the beauty here is it's really easy to do it. I can just say update database again. And we just rolled forward again. And so again, if I check here, we'll find that nullable now should be false. And again, if I hit refresh on this page, my data has been preserved. And even though I've just evolved the schema on the fly, no data has been lost. What's nice about this overall approach is basically each of these steps is checked in as code. And so you can actually check it in as a separate file in source control. But because the first number there is a, it looks random, but it's actually a date, and it includes the seconds. If you're in a team environment where you have five or six developers working together on a single project, they can each separately check in migration steps. And then when you do a sync and you do an update database, you can actually roll forward to the merged version of the database automatically. So you don't have to worry about one master SQL file being checked in and everyone having to do manual diffs. Instead, you can kind of nicely parse and change this on the fly. How many people here ever renamed a property in their code and had to go through and update the database all over the place? It's kind of a pain. So last sort of migration, let's just do. Let's change to age to be years since birth. I don't know why you'd do that, but let's say we did. One of the things you can do here is I'm going to change this, and then I'm just going to go through here and just change these two places as well. And then we'll go to our create step and do the same. So changed all my code. Let's actually now go ahead and run a migration to convert it. One nice thing about the migration kind of approach is you'll see here if I do add migration, I'm going to say change age. Oops. Change patient age. Because we didn't run it immediately, you'll notice that what it generated in this case is code that actually I don't want to do because it looked at the class and it looked at the database and said, oh, you got rid of the age property, but you had this year since birth. And so it looked at it and added and dropped a column. So this will work. But obviously, the problem here is I'm going to lose any data that I already have inside the age column. And so before, because you can actually change it before you run it, one nice thing is I could actually just change this to say, oh, actually, no, instead I want to do a rename column. And I'm just going to change this from age to be year since birth. And you can add any custom logic you want in this. You can also run arbitrary SQL code as part of the statement. So if you want to do update a view or something like that that isn't built in through the object model, you can do that. And again, we're doing both the up and the down so that I can actually roll my schema forward. But at any point, if I want to, I can also roll it back. And now what I should be able to do, it's inside my window here. I can say update database. This, if I go into my Server Explorer, hit refresh, you'll see years since birth is my new property. And again, if I go back here and hit refresh, you'll see I've now renamed my schema to be years since birth. All my data is preserved and everything is still working. So pretty easy way for you to start iterating. It's very agile friendly, very code friendly. Last thing people often will say is, well, my DBA is going to hate this because suddenly now I'm checking in database schema and code. How do we make him or her comfortable with this overall model? So the nice thing about this is not only can you roll backwards and forwards in code, if you want to, you can give them a DLL and they can actually run a command line tool. Most DBAs will hate that though. They go, hey, I want a .SQL file. I want to see exactly what you're doing. Well, one of the things you can do is you can also go ahead and say update database with a dash script option. And then you can actually say, what's my source migration? So where do I want to start in this overall process? So in this case here, let's say we want to do initial database. And then I can say, what's my target migration? So in other words, where do I want to end up? And so the last migration step we did was called change patient age. So let's just do change patient age, like so. And when I run this now, what this will do is it will automatically generate for me a .SQL change script that will start with whatever migration I specified as the beginning and then went all the way to the final one. And I can basically now hand this off to a DBA, and they could just run this inside SQL Management Studio, and it would automatically create the schema for me. And what's nice is in this case here, I started with the initial database. So in other words, it's showing me the create table. But if I started with a later migration, it would actually show me the change diff from that point in time to the live version. So if you've already got a version 1 of your app deployed and you just want to update the database to match version 2, you can basically use this approach to create the change script, preserve all your data. The DBA just has to run this, or you can run this on your remote hosting site and then deploy your code and your app will just work. So a really easy way for you now to kind of migrate your schema forwards and backwards. It's very code friendly. It's built in. Just works great with power, with a built-in NuGet PowerShell command window. You can also run it standalone inside an XE. So if you want to automate this as part of your build server, you can do that as well. And again, it'll work with any version of ASP.NET, including MVC. Any questions on that real quick? Yeah. Good question. So the question is, what happens if you run arbitrary code. So for example, I'm trying to think, there's a command here which is SQL. So you just say SQL, and you can basically run arbitrary SQL in your up and down command. So if you want to do custom indexes or something like that, you can do that. I think there's actually also an index command built in. Create index is also built in. But let's say you want to do a custom index for some reason, I just want a raw SQL. So when you run the generate the .SQL file, it would actually include that SQL file in the .SQL script. And so basically, in theory, this should let you do anything you want as a developer, take full advantage of SQL Server. And again, at the end of the day, the DBA can look at it, make sure it's right, and then use whatever tool they want in order to execute it. You can also, directly from the tool, if you have permissions, you can just point to your remote database, and you can run the script directly from the PowerShell command as well. But we've specifically tried to make sure that typically in most enterprise workflows, you know, there's kind of a more controlled change workflow than just the dev randomly changing the schema. And so that's why we want to make sure you can create the .SQL file. Another question? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great question. So the question is, hey, what happens if I want to change, let's say I want to do either a destructive change or some kind of conversion as part of my migration. So let's say I want to change the int, an age, to be date of birth, and I want to use a date time format. So one of those things about, because we're running code inside the migration, you can actually, as part of your up, you could actually execute a SQL statement to say, generate a temp table with a transform of all these things, change the schema, and then reapply the modified versions. And so absolutely you can do very complicated code conversions or format conversions as part of your migration script. And you can do that both on the up and the down case. So if at some point you realize, oh, no, we want to go back to integers, you don't have to lose the data. You could actually write the reverse equivalent inside your down method. So any other last question on this and we'll move on? Yeah. Yes, the question is, can you include arbitrary code? The beauty of this is, so like for example, I want to include .NET code as part of the migration. The beauty about the migration is you're just writing code, so you can have any arbitrary complex logic that you want inside there. And so, yeah, you can call into other libraries. You can call into regular expression libraries. You can call in any .NET library within the migration. So it's pretty powerful. There are other frameworks I should mention up front that do actually incorporate this. So Rails kind of made this popular. We kind of think we've taken from other frameworks in terms of some goodness. We've also added some unique stuff in terms of the EF code first integration so you don't have to manually write your migration script. You can actually just sort of automatically base it by default on what your current model POCO class looks like. And we think this kind of is a hopefully a pretty nice feature, adds a lot of productivity, and rounds out MVC in a nice way. So that was a little bit migration, so let's keep moving on. Mobile web. How many people here build websites or web apps for mobile devices? Cool. 3 people, 4 people, 5 people. How many people here have a phone? Cool. Only half. Interesting. Typically, one of the things we expect to see, obviously, is more and more mobile traffic usage on the web. And so mobile enabling your application is going to become increasingly important in the future. Good news is with MVC4, we're making it really easy to go ahead and build mobile-optimized web apps and websites. There's a couple of different kind of trends that we support in terms of doing this with MVC4, and so you can actually choose kind of how you opt in. Because a lot of people say, look, I want it to work on a phone, but I really don't want to have to do much work to make it work. Other people say, hey, I want to have a mobile-optimized version because our app is all about phone. And so you can choose at what point in the spectrum you want to opt in and how much work you want to do in order to enable it. At one end, you can do what's called adaptive rendering, which basically means you just write one version of your site, and you can use our standard CSS techniques in order to make sure it works on a tablet or on a phone. We have a feature called display mode that allows you to kind of do overrides on a per device or per capability basis within your view templates. And then we also have kind of a fully mobile enabled template that takes advantage of jQuery mobile that you can use in order to do that. And let's see some demos of that in action. So, hey, let's go back to our Poltergeist site. And remember I mentioned we have a new default template that's in the box. And so by default, when you see file new project, you get this wonderful template. One of the things I showed earlier was how it kind of adaptively uses HTML5. So notice how the logo up here with the navigation, depending on the size of the browser, repositions dynamically. By default, we're taking advantage of new CSS features like viewport as well as CSS media queries so that by default, you just get that regardless of your browser size. So for example here, if I go into my layout, you'll see there is at the top a viewport setting that we're using. So we're actually setting use the max width of the device, so scale the content across it. And then if you go into your CSS file, you'll see that by default, a little bit lower on, we're using media queries so that we can mobile enable things by default so that if I took this exact same app and ran it on another device, let's say like an iPhone, notice that it still works. It scales appropriately to fit the content, and I don't actually need to run any code by default in order to actually have it work on any type of phone device. It works on Windows Phone as well. I thought show that just to make it real. reels in working with other devices, not that there's more of those in the world. that sounded bad. But anyway, moving on. So that was kind of by default, you just get that, and you could take advantage. All of our features by default are kind of designed to work with viewports and media queries. And so, again, you can have a kind of one code base and have it work with multiple form factors. What you can also do, though, is optionally now within MVC, override your view templates so that you can customize it on a per-device basis. So this is going one step further on that spectrum, where I do want to actually invest a little bit more time and code in order to customize my look and feel depending on the form factor of the device. So, for example, the way I can do that is by default, it's convention-based. Again, you can override it if you want to. But I could, for example, take this layout page that's defining the outer chrome of my application, and I could change this to be, instead of calling underscore layout, I'm going to change this to be underscore layout.mobile.cshtml. And now if I hit this site with the default browser, I'm going to use the same layout page that I had before. But if I hit this with a mobile device, so let's say a phone, I'll use this alternative layout by default for all the view templates within my site. And just to make this a little bit more mobile-friendly or phone-friendly, I'm just going to paste in an alternative view template. It's not super fancy. But all I've done is I, for example, moved my navigation to the bottom below the content, and I've reduced a bunch of clutter at the top. And so if I hit this now with my standard browser here, you notice it looks exactly the same as it did before. But if I go here now and reload the page, whoops. One second here. I wasn't planning on using the Poltergeist site. Let me just do that. If I hit with this layout page, and just in the interest of time, let me get rid of all this default content so we can just say some content goes here. Hi. Copy this URL, go into here, paste it. And what you can see here is I now have a mobile optimized layout. I've stripped out the stuff at the top. I've moved my navigation at the bottom. The beauty here is if I hit it with the standard device, I can still get it here. Oops, I stripped that out. But you can see basically the differences are I have one index page, so one set of controllers, one set of views, desktop, phone optimized. Obviously, I could probably invest more time in making the phone optimized version look a little prettier. But this gives you a sense of all I need to do is just change one layout file and add a .mobile extension to it. And now I have the kind of ability to very cleanly within my code start to optimize the UI for different form factors. The .mobile is built into the box, but you can also specify your own custom devices. So if you wanted to have a .iOS or .Windows Phone or .Win8, tablet, you could basically provide custom view templates there instead, and then at runtime, ASP.NET can automatically choose the most appropriate template in order to use to render. You can do that on a layout page basis. You can also override individual view templates. But the nice thing about kind of modern browsers is within your individual view templates, you can often have the exact same content and just at the layout page override the rendering depending on the form factor. And so that kind of allows you to avoid having to create a completely custom site, but at the same time, you can selectively mobile optimize portions of the site or app. Then the last approach you can do in terms of mobile optimization in MVC 4 is we also have, by default, built into the box, a mobile application template. And so you can basically choose this template, and this will basically, by default, create a site for you that is mobile optimized. We're using jQuery mobile by default. And so you'll notice if I run this now and hit this, we get a site. It's not going to look super great in a browser. I mean, it's going to look kind of weird in a browser, but it's basically optimized for mobile devices. So it has navigation with some nice styling. It does have mobile login built in to the overall experience. And again, it'll work with any type of browser or device. And so it provides a really easy way that you can go in, you can use standard ASP.NET, you can use standard HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and you can basically have kind of a mobile optimized version of your app that just works. And so this way, if you want to take true advantage of touch, if you want to take true advantage of a small screen real estate, having jQuery mobile built in and integrated with ASP.NET hopefully makes it really easy to do so. Any quick questions on that? Cool. So it's a little bit about mobile. Halfway through, we only have 15 minutes left. Great. So let's move on to the next feature. This is kind of a pretty big feature we're pretty excited about, which is web API support. How many people here are creating web APIs? How many people here are using web APIs? How many people here have no idea what a web API is? Cool, a few people. So why web API? So basically the goal behind a web API is, the main motivation behind it is it allows you to build richer apps and build even richer client experiences and reach more devices. Why would you care about that? Well, turns out there's lots of devices coming out in the world. Browsers are obviously one of them, but increasingly there's other devices as well. Win8 slates, iOS apps, whether they're phones or iPads, Android devices. And these devices often, if you're building an app native to the experience, need some ability to exchange data back and forth between the server. And ideally what you want to be able to do is build it in one way and have that back end work across any device form factor. There's lots of companies out there doing this. If you look back over the last couple of years, more and more sites are exposing endpoints or what they call web APIs that people can consume. You know, if you're using Twitter, eBay, Facebook, et cetera, the cool thing is, as a developer, they have APIs that you can integrate with. You can call and exchange data in a really easy way. And we want to let you do that with ASP.NET and have a really nice integrated application experience as part of it. One of the things we're trying to do as part of this is embrace HTTP. And so we're using kind of web API. One of the kind of differences between web APIs and, say, SOAP, or RPC, other mechanisms, XML RPC and other mechanisms that were used before, is that increasingly web APIs are kind of embracing HTTP not as a transport protocol, but actually as a first-class application protocol. And so you want to be able to use concepts like status codes inside HTTP to reflect behavior. You want to be able to use headers like location and REST in order to actually provide semantics. We want to make sure that we have a really great API inside .NET in order to expose it. How many people here have used the WCF Web API framework? A few people have. It's been in beta, it's in preview for a couple iterations now. One of the things that we've recently done is actually merge the WCF team and the ASP.NET team together. And so we actually took the Web API project and said, hey, we have MVC, which allows you to create HTTP endpoints. We got Web API that lets you create HTTP endpoints. Rather than have two different ways to do it, is there ways that we can kind of integrate the two and have the best of both worlds? And so one of the things you'll see, again, with the MVC 4 beta coming out later this week, is that we've kind of merged the two together and have a really nice seamless experience. It has all the best of the WCF web API, but at the same time allows you to integrate with MVC as well. So you can use the same IOC container, the same testing approach, and we've kind of merged the object model and the attribute formats in a kind of a nice way. And so with that, let's go ahead and build some web APIs. So we're going to go back to our Poltergeist site. And let's go ahead and enable someone to build a rich client front end against it. So there's lots of great talks here at the event on how to build, say, Windows 8 apps or Windows Phone apps. Let's go ahead and expose some endpoints using HTTP that allow people to program against our patient data and display it and manipulate it, which is a great example of probably a web API you wouldn't want to write. But let's say this was a hospital that was very open and free with its medical records. We want people to be able to query our confidential information and do whatever they want with it. So we're going to start by creating an APIs folder inside our project. And so typically, I'm going to, you can either put your APIs inside your controllers folder. I'm actually just keep it inside the APIs folder because I think it's a little bit cleaner to explain. And I'm going to add a new item into that. And I'm going to add what's called a Web API Controller class. And I'm just going to call this products controller for right now. Because it's in a separate folder, I can actually have a, or not a products controller, a patients controller. And so we'll say new item. We'll say patients controller. And we're just going to get rid of the default cruft here, and we're going to build it from scratch. Basically, we want to go ahead and expose the patient data. I still can't get over that. The scenario through JSON and XML. So what can I do here? So you notice here we have a patients controller class. It's sort of like a standard MVC controller, except it derives from an API controller-based class instead of controller. This is an object model a little bit more tuned for web APIs and has some built-in features that we'll take advantage of. To expose it here, let's create an endpoint. And I'm going to say it's an HTTP GET, and I'm going to have the URI be API patients. Will be the URL that someone sends our website, and then we want to go ahead and return a JSON-based format of a patient. and I'm just going to say patient, and we're going to, because I'm going to use a convention that we kind of support, which is just name the method get. I could also call it get patient if I wanted to, and I'm just going to actually return all the patients. And I'm just going to say return, I want to use that hospital class that we created earlier. So what was it called? It was called hospital DB context. And so I'm just going to return from here all the patients. So return db.patients.toList. That's all I needed to do in order to actually expose all the patients. Let's just, in the interest of time, we're going to add one more here. So I'm going to say int ID. And so if I want to return an individual patient, I can do that too. And so I'm just going to say return patient. And I'm just going to say dot single b.id is equal to the ID that was passed in. So basically, I have two endpoints exposed. I'm using a RESTful pattern. I don't have to use REST, but it's pretty common to do so. And it's kind of a nice default if you're working with data. To activate this, we're going to actually have a nice built-in test client. It's not in the beta. So instead, I'm going to use Fiddler, which is kind of an open source tool. Let's just make sure our app is site's running. Grab the URL. And now within Fiddler, I can go in here, click the Composer tab. I can paste in a URL, hit execute. And what you'll see here is if I go ahead and hit the slash API patients, I don't know if people can see that, URI on the site, I'm sending a standard GET request. Basically, it returned back a 200 full of patient data encoded inside JSON. And if I look at the raw HTML content, you can see it's embedded nicely in JSON format. And so this is now returning data from my app of customer patient data. If I want to individually return a single patient, I could just say patient one, execute this, and now that just brought back a single individual patient from my site. So that's kind of how I could basically programmatically now expose it. Notice that the JSON formatting is built in. And this is because the API controller has a notion of what we call content negotiation built into it and a notion of multiple format types that you can use. And so the beauty about the API controller is we're kind of format agnostic. You can use JSON, you can use XML. If you've got your own custom schema, you can register that. And what's nice is you don't need to actually specify your formats on your controller. Instead, you can register them globally for your app. And then we'll sort of use HTTP. So if a site says, hey, I really don't want JSON, I want it in XML, I could just say, I could set an accept. Accept application slash XML. And you'll notice now, instead of getting back JSON, we're actually just automatically formatted the response back in XML. So without you having to change any of your code on the server side, I can now support JSON, I can support XML. And again, you could plug in your own custom vertical formats into the back end, and all Wave API can automatically expose them for you. Anyone here using OData? Anyone here know what OData is? Yeah, a few people. It's a wire format. Basically allows you to specify things like queries and sorting and paging over lots of data. If you change your API from iQueryable to iEnumerable, like I am right now, you can go ahead and go back in time here. Let's burn some OData. This will just work. And then, so I returning the same data here. It's a slash patients, and it's returning back whether it's XML or JSON. But what you can do here now is, because I specified iQueryable again by default, I could go ahead and say just take two requests. And if I wanted to, I could say skip $skip one into the sequence, and let's order by ID. Execute. And now this automatically took the response that came back from the server. It skipped into the result. It ordered it, and it sorted it, and returned just two results. And so, again, without me having to write any custom code in order to process it, I'm very easily able to expose my data. A client app can consume this and do paging and sorting automatically on top of it. Other quick things, not only can you return data, you can also update data. And so let's just do a post request so that we can modify patient data. So I'm going to allow you to kind of create a new patient. And so I'm just going to create a method called post. We do automatic parsing of data. So let's, for example, I don't have to kind of manually look at the incoming request. I can actually just say I want a patient object, and we'll automatically shred the incoming payload to that object. And then I could just say db.patients.add. And I could say db.saveChanges. And I could return the patient. And so if I do this now, I could go back into Fiddler. I go Composer. I'm going to clear all this out. And I'm going to say I am sending a content type of JSON in this case, or I could do XML. The beauty is content negotiation just works both directions. And then I'm going to post into this. Find a way to resize my window. I'm going to post into this something that looks like this. Send a post. I'm going to say name. Name was Scott. Oh, God, what was the property? It was years since birth, which is really long to type. So I'm just going to copy paste it. And it was just my birthday. So now I can execute this, and what you'll see here is we just generated a new record in the hospital with my data and returned back the result. And again, the beauty here is the amount of code you have to write is really simple. Now, a lot of people, if they're REST heads or HTTP Web API heads, will say, hey, it's great that you created this, but if I look at the payload here, I'm returning back a 200 request, which is not perfectly the right thing to do if you believe in REST. Often with REST, what Web API people will tell you is use the HTTP status code, not just to return success or failure, but to actually indicate semantics as well. So in other words, you shouldn't really return a 200. You should return a 201 object created command, because that more specifically maps to what this post action is. And one nice thing about the Web API work is you can be as specific or as detailed as you want as part of this. And so, for example, instead of returning back a patient, I could also say I want to return back an HTTP response message of type patient if I want to include additional information back to the client. So if I wanted to, I could say result, new HTTP response message, patient. And I'm going to pass in my patient object. And then if I wanted to, I could even be more specific, and I could say I want to respond, return the patient object, and I'm going to do HTTP status code dot created, which is the appropriate HTTP command to send. And then just for further giggles, I'm going to say headers dot location and say new URI. And one of the other things that REST, when you recreate something, recommended convention is to actually point to the new object. And so I could say request dot URI, And then I'm just going to say API slash patients plus p dot id dot toString. And then I'm just going to return the result. And so now, instead of just returning a patient, I'm returning a more detailed HTTP message. Go back to my Fiddler, compose this. We're going to create David, son, 3. And I hit execute. And you'll see here now I'm returning an HTTP 201 request. And if you look in the payload, I'm automatically embedding the URI in order to actually look up his specific detail information. Very easily I can be kind of as kind of just works, or I can get kind of down and dirty in the HTTP commands and custom tweak everything in a really rich way. Last 3 minutes. Testing. How many people are into unit testing? How many people here hate mocking and faking things out? Good news about the web API work is we've removed dependencies on static context objects. So it's really easy to unit test. You can now supply all of your parameters with simple parameter types in the constructor. There's no need to actually mock anything anymore. You can just say, create a request message, give it to us, take the response message, and assert it. We also now integrate the web API work with a standard MVC dependency resolver. So you can use a single container or IOC dependency framework in order to resolve all references for both standard controllers as well as web API controllers at runtime. So a simple example of this would be, like so. And so within my unit tests here, I have a simple controller, takes a repository, and then basically I'm doing something very similar to what we did before, where I'm adding to the repository and then returning a complex HTTP result. And again, within my unit test, if I want to do a simple test, I can basically just create the controller, call the method, and assert the result. I don't need to, again, set any statics. If I want to do something more complicated where I want to send a custom request object in and I want to do a custom response object out, again, you'll notice I don't need to do any mocking framework. I can actually just pass in the request. I can get back the response, and I can use standard asserts against it. And it just works out of the box. So much easier testing all built in. Other benefits of the web API work is it works not only in ASP.NET and IIS, but you can also run it in other applications as well. So we often hear from people, hey, I want to run this in a worker role inside Azure. I want to run this in an NT service or a command line console app, and I want to be able to expose REST endpoints from those types of apps. The web API work is designed to have the same programming model, and it'll work not only in ASP.NET, but outside ASP.NET. And so, for example, I could go ahead here. I have a simple controller doing the exact same thing that we had before, this well, product instead of patient. And basically, this is all the code necessary inside a command line console app in order to host this application on port 8080. So now I have a web API hosted there. I can plug in and say API slash hello. And if I go ahead and hit this method, and assuming IE will let me get access to it, it'll basically show me the JSON that was returned. There's the simple product listing that came back. So really easy, the same kind of characteristics that the WCF web API work had. I can run it both in ASP.NET and IIS as well as outside. Other quick two last things in my overspill time. Real-time communication. This is kind of a cool, fun thing. We're making it really easy with ASP.NET going forward. The idea here is how can you do push notifications from a server to a client? So if you ever wanted to do real-time notifications to your browser clients, or you ever wanted to do browser-to-browser communication, we have a cool new framework coming out called SignalR. It works in MVC. It also works in vanilla ASP.NET. Makes it really easy to do that. Like web APIs, the nice thing about it is it supports content negotiation. So you can go ahead and on Windows 8 and .NET 4.5, we support WebSockets automatically. We also fall back to other approaches as well. One last thing, and then I'll get off, is basically you write some client-side. The way it works is you write some server-side code, and you create what's called a hub class. So in this case here, I'm calling it chat. And you can expose a public method, in this case, send message. What you then do inside your JavaScript client is you just add a reference here using our API. You can say connection.chat to connect to it on the server. And then what you can do is, inside any of your standard JavaScript, you can say hub.sendMessage, and this will turn around and actually call the server message, and you can marshal arguments down to the server. What then gets cool is the server can call back to the client, and so all you need to do is expose on the hub a client-side message, in this case, add message. And then on the server side, you can either to an individual client or broadcast to all the clients, you can say, call this message and pass whatever arguments you want. And under the covers, ASP.NET will do all the connection management for you. So even if you have 10,000 simultaneous users, you can broadcast this message to all of them. And we'll do firewall traversals, where WebSockets is available. We'll use WebSockets, but we can also fall back, so this will even work with IE7. And so here's a simple example of this in action. Hit signal R. The simple app here, I've defined a class on the server called MoveShape. It's got one method called MoveShape. All it does is it takes an int X and Y, and then it broadcasts to any listening clients and says, hey, we just moved the thing. Then I have a simple HTML file. It doesn't even use ASP.NET. It's just vanilla HTML. We reference signal R. We reference that hub class right there. And then I have a simple client-side script file. It's just connecting to the hub. It writes a little bit of jQuery, and so every time you actually click on a shape inside the browser, see it in just a second, it just calls the server. The server then goes ahead and says, anyone else that's listening, here's the new updated location of the shape. And so if I open another browser, in this case here we use Chrome and IE side by side, they both have the same shape. If you move one, the other one moves as well. And this is running locally, but you can also broadcast it to any number of servers or machines anywhere on the web. Again, it'll automatically use WebSockets where it's available. It'll automatically use long polling or long frames and our custom approaches there as well. And you could do even richer things than moving shapes around the object. For example, there's a cool open source chat room called Jabber that you can use. If you want, you can sign in. And this basically, I won't do it in the interest of time, but basically this gives you kind of a real-time chat room interface, and so as soon as someone makes a message, it goes to everyone. Makes it really easy to do this inside MVC. Again, you can use it in MVC, you can also use it in other ASP.NET apps, and we're kind of scaling this so you can actually handle thousands of concurrent users. Ultimately, we want to make it work across web farms so you could actually have millions of concurrent users all going on the web. So lots of cool ways that you can start to apply it. Last thing I'll talk about, but without showing a demo, is asynchronous support. How many people here use async today? A few people have. Why use it? It's more efficient on the server. It uses threads, uses fewer threads, and it uses fewer server resources, and so it makes things more efficient. It's been in ASP.NET since the very beginning. It's been supported in MVC since MVC2. Basically, the way it works is you write code on the server like a controller class. Whenever you go and call something that's going to take a long time to complete, you yield back your thread to ASP.NET. We can then use that thread to process another request, and then when your network request completes, we requeue you and we continue executing your code. And again, it allows us to kind of reduce the number of threads and improve scalability. It's not exposed to the client, so you just have a standard URL that you expose. Whether you're processing this in a synchronous or asynchronous way is completely oblivious to the caller. This is what you need to write today in order to enable it. It's kind of messy code, and in general, unless you really, really need to with async, recommend not doing it because it's sometimes error-prone from a coding perspective. A lot of people inadvertently screw it up. But this is kind of what you need to do. You have to have two methods. You have to do callbacks, and you have to pass around a lot of state in order to manage it. One of the cool things that's coming with the new release of 4.5 is new language support that's built into C# and VB to make async trivially easy to implement. And so what you can do now is instead of having to write all this code, you instead just write, and so today you'd actually derive from async controller. With MVC4, you can just derive from the controller base class. You write one action method, and then anytime you want to have a method that's async, you just add an async keyword in front of your method. And then anytime you make a call to a remote object that's asynchronous, you just say await, and then you do the call. Under the covers, the compiler will actually split this method into multiple methods and yield back the result while you're waiting on that thing and then reschedule the work. The beauty is the compiler does all that. You don't have to worry about it. You can just treat this like synchronous code and process it as normal. Benefit, though, is you get dramatically faster performance. We're measuring .NET 4.5 and MVC. Literally, we're testing against hundreds of thousands and millions of concurrent users. Combined with things like SignalR, things like Web API, things like mobile, it means that you can do a lot more with fewer servers and really reach a lot more customers. So lots of new features coming. I'm actually over time. Apologize about that, but hopefully you saw just a sampling of them. There's even more features that will be coming out. All of them will work with VS 2010 and .NET 4. The async stuff, the nice language support does require VS 11, although the core async functionality will also still work in VS 10 and .NET 4. Hopefully lots of things you can do. Excited to announce the beta will be available later this week, hopefully Thursday, and you'll be able to download and run all the demos that I showed here, and we're really looking forward to seeing what you build with it. So thanks a bunch, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the week.